You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at 3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
But that's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, this is Stay Tuned in Brief. I'm Preet Bharara. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and to honor the great civil rights leader, I wanted to spend some time talking about his impact on our politics today and also about his legacy. My guest is Dr. Andra Gillespie. She's a professor of political science at Emory University and an expert in campaigns, elections, and voting behavior. Her work has focused on Black politics, particularly the leaders of the post-civil rights generation. Dr. Gillespie, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So obviously, we could talk for hours and hours and days about the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., but I thought on a day like this, there are a few spots we could hit and talk about Dr. King. So remind folks who may not be so well-versed and who understand Dr. King to be basically universally revered, at least by people's rhetoric, if not necessarily always in their hearts, that when he was alive and at the maximum of his power, at the maximum of his popularity, how popular was he?
He wasn't universally popular at the height of his notoriety. So if we think about that period in the early to mid-1960s, say from the March on Washington to the time that he came out against the Vietnam War, if you look at public opinion data from that era, you actually find out that he's a pretty controversial figure. So the data that we would use to infer favorability, or I guess the things that would be comparable to a favorability rating today, certainly show that he was really controversial. And there were a lot of people who viewed him with either disdain or skepticism. And we forget that because everybody seems to claim King these days.
Yes, they do. We're going to get to some of the false claiming of King in a moment.
Yeah. But some of these people, if they had been alive and socially and politically active back in the early 1960s, these would have been people who would have opposed him. And I think we need to be really reflective of that, especially when we choose to appropriate him in probably ahistorical ways.
Yeah, you mentioned some phrases like people were skeptical of him. Were there people who feared him or feared what he stood for?
Certainly, I'm making inferences here. If we think about COINTELPRO, so we know that the FBI was following King at every turn as he was following other civil rights leaders. The idea that, you know, that our federal government would be abusing a criminal justice apparatus in order to keep an eye on the activities of civil rights leaders because they viewed them as agitators and viewed them as potentially dangerous is, you know, something that would be of note. You know, King ultimately stood for shaking up the status quo, and we often forget that for a number of reasons, not just because of the ways that we misappropriate and co-opt him today, but also during the time period today, his stance on nonviolence looks Pollyannish to some people and doesn't look radical enough. But right. We also forget that in the late 50s and early 1960s, the idea of going out and protesting and standing up and publicly resisting segregation was seen as very radical at the time. And so I think we need to make sure that we're always thinking about these things in context and realize that what King stood for, even if it seems quaint today, was actually very, very radical for its time.
Describe, if you will, the level of King's popularity in the Black community, because in popular discussions, there was another figure who overlapped with King, also met a tragic death by assassination, Malcolm X. What was the level of his popularity within the Black community at his height?
So the public opinion data for African-Americans during that time period in general is scant. So when I think of the things that I've seen kind of looking through historical archives, I haven't seen that type of data that could parse out how many people were supporters of Martin Luther King versus how many people were supporters of Malcolm X. But we do know from the historical record that King and the SCLC tended to be most effective in the southern region where they were primarily located and where they primarily operated. King did try to expand the civil rights movement beyond the South. He also tried to expand the civil rights movement behind the basic things that people agreed on, like trying to dismantle segregation in public accommodations and in voting rights. And when he tried to expand the message to be more complex, to talk about economic justice and to venture into foreign policy and international politics and to oppose the Vietnam War, he met with resistance in various places. So in the anti-war stance, most people would attribute his anti-war stance as actually contributing to the SCLC and the civil rights movement's ability in general to raise money during the late 1960s. It's also true that there were other causes that were competing for funding during that time period. But in particular, when King tried to expand the civil rights movement and move north, he spent a summer in Chicago, and there he was not necessarily greeted with open arms. And that actually highlights some of the differences in terms of socially how Black communities were organized outside of the South, where you couldn't make the assumptions that everybody went to church in the same way as they may have done in the South, and that wasn't actually 100% true either. And also that there may be class differences where a middle class, well-educated person like Dr. King may be met with resistance from other people who had experienced a type of systemic poverty that limited their chances. And then we could also just talk about some of the tactical differences. And so, you know, when King and the SCLC were first kind of coming to prominence and notoriety, there were folks who wanted to take a much more measured approach.
How do you explain King's arc reputationally from being controversial in the 60s to being pretty universally admired, at least outwardly today, even though along the way, as we celebrate Martin Luther King Day, even the creation of this holiday was stridently opposed by a number of politicians. How did that happen?
You know, I think that there are a couple of things. I think one, we have to think about media archetypes and the idea of unifying around personalities. And so while King was a driving force behind the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and, you know, some people use that as a critique of having leadership by personality and kind of what the structural challenges that actually provide social movements and organizations. In America, we like to think about media-appointed leaders. And so if somebody is getting a lot of attention, then that person becomes a leader rightly or wrongly. And so King certainly benefited from a lot of the media attention that he got. And our challenge today is to remember the unsung heroes who were working alongside King, particularly the people who would have been even further marginalized, you know, in Black communities for other characteristics like race or sexuality, who were doing the work alongside him and couldn't, and King wouldn't have been able to do the things that he was able to do if not for their leadership and their assistance. Also, you know, there is the idea of martyrdom, and there are philosophers who could talk about this much better than I could, but the idea that he was killed at such a young and tragic age, that actually helps people to kind of rally around him. And that might actually be eliciting a certain type of psychological response where you're more willing to embrace his ideas or at least claim to embrace his ideas because he can't be a threat. He can't evolve anymore.
And I think the martyrdom, I think it's an exceptional point. I think that also accounts for JFK's reputation.
Right. We hold these people in like amber, and that allows them to be two-dimensional and static. And that actually doesn't allow us to embrace the complexities that they lived. And also understanding that had they been able to live, they may have done different things. They may have continued on the trajectory they were on at the time of their death. They also could have taken very, very different turns.
I've always marveled at many things having to do with King. And one of those things is just how young he was. And he doesn't appear young. So he was killed at age 39. He never made it to 40. When he gave the March on Washington speech, the most famous speech he ever delivered, I believe he was like 33 right? Or 34. And he doesn't present, no offense to 30-somethings in the modern world, but he doesn't present like a 30-something. Is there something about his bearing and the baritone quality of his voice and his maturity that allowed him to come to the fore in the civil rights movement? Could he have done that without having some of those physical qualities?
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't feel qualified to be able to talk about the timbre of his voice or even the homiletic tradition that he's in that kind of comes out of the Black church that certainly elicits a particular rhetorical style. But there are a couple of things that I would point out. I think just in terms of like development and life stage, psychologists would probably talk about sort of different types of conditioning today. Where, you know, a 34-year-old in the early 1960s would have been expected to be married, to have children, and to have kind of been a fully fledged adult in ways that because of advanced schooling and actually also because of, you know, increases in longevity generally, we don't necessarily impose on people at the same age status today. So I think that that's part of it. Like everybody seemed older back then. So, you know, I think about my own grandparents during that era who were a little bit older and you're like, wow, at that stage, they had been married almost 20 years and had a bunch of kids and all of that kind of stuff. And it's definitely not where I was when I was their age. So I think, you know, part of that is different. The other thing is, I think understanding why King was put forward as the face of the Montgomery Improvement Association and the Montgomery bus boycott movement. Part of the reason why they selected King was because he was relatively new to Montgomery at the time. And so because he was relatively new, you know, he hadn't been around long enough to cultivate any enemies. And so they figured people would take the fresh face and the fresh voice of it, of him. So, you know, that's part of the reason why he was chosen. And so I think we also have to kind of think about what it means to be, you know, in the right place at the right time. And that seems to have benefited King.
Dr. King advocated, as we've discussed, for nonviolent protest, which I think people underestimate the degree of courage and bravery and physical bravery that took to be beaten by officers and law enforcement officials while you're standing up for independence and liberty and equal rights. Lately, I feel like in this country, there's a move back towards violence and protest. We have the insurrection from January 6th. What do you think King would think about violent protest in America today?
You know, I am reminded of the fact that his youngest daughter, Bernice King, you know, heads the King Center, and she does run a nonviolence program that particularly focuses on young people and teaching them the skills of conflict resolution. You know, the assumption is that King would still be promoting nonviolence. We imagine that if you were alive and you'd heard Michelle Obama in 2016 say, when they go low, we go high, that's definitely something that he would have applauded. In part because of the civil rights movement and the fact that it emerges at a time where mass communication is really coming into its forefront. The contrast that you could see between peaceful marchers dressed in their Sunday best being hosed down or having dogs sicked on them provided a contrast that really, I think, in many instances emphasized the righteousness of the cause of civil rights during the long civil rights movement and perhaps the depravity of those who wanted to uphold and maintain the system of segregation.
We talked about the arc of Dr. King's reputation. If you'd indulge me in the counterfactual, and I'm sure you've gotten this question a lot, and people ask us about leaders who die young. If you could predict what the arc of his career might have been had he lived for several more decades, do you think Dr. King would have ever considered running for public office himself? How did he regard politicians? And do you think that would have been a possibility?
You know, I am not sure. It's not something that I would consider. You know, I think Claiborne Carson would actually probably be a better person to consider that. I mean, we know after the civil rights movement, there were people who were foot soldiers in the movement, some who held pretty prominent positions, who went on to hold public office at the local,
or at least ran,
state, well, or national level.
Jesse Jackson ran for president. John Lewis was a member of Congress for many years. So
absolutely. And so King wouldn't have had to have done that in order to hold his place in history or his place in the movement. I think people would have listened to him as an elder statesman in the movement, regardless of whether or not he held those offices. And I think that there perhaps could have been a model, or he could have served as a model if he had chosen not to run for office, about how effective one needs to be. The political scientist Ron Walters talked about the inside-outside strategy and about how, as we move from protest to politics, as Bayard Rustin called for African Americans to do in the wake of the imminent passage of the Voting Rights Act, Ron Walters argued 20 years later that it was important for Blacks to be in elective office, to have a seat at the table, and then for Blacks to continue to use protest as a tool of agitation to keep elected officials who ran on pro-civil rights agendas honest, and then also to set the agenda so that people could use protests going on the outside as a means of convincing their colleagues on the inside of legislative offices that this is a that we have to deal with these issues because the people are clamoring for change in that way. So I think that one could make the argument that he could have been effective both as an elected official, but also as an elder statesman. But I think there are others who could speak to the probability of his being willingness to do so. I think the big question that I have about King is, as other issues started to come to the forefront, would King have, been, as supportive of expanding our idea of what civil rights was? And so those are our questions that
like economic
we'll
rights,
always have. Yeah.
Like economic rights and also the war in Vietnam.
Yeah. He did expand, and it's a question of would he have expanded further? I mean, we could look at Coretta Scott King and so her embrace of those activities, her embrace of LGBTQ rights, right? And I think the question would be of would they have been in lockstep with each other?
So as we commemorate Martin Luther King Jr. Day, if people want to honor him, what's the work of his that they should read, and why is it Letter from Birmingham Jail?
I was going to suggest a letter from a Birmingham jail, in part because it is short, but also it's incisive. And there are
so people know why I'm asking the question, I think it's one of the greatest works in the English language. I've had my children read it. I have my little copy in my basement office, which I read from time to time. It's really extraordinary. And if anybody hasn't read it, read it, because as the doctor will tell you, it's very powerful stuff.
Yeah, it's powerful for a lot of reasons. So King is writing this letter to white pastors who were telling him that his agitation was actually undermining the civil rights movement. So there's this larger narrative there about the role of white churches and their complicity with their silence. And telling them that, this is the time to do this. You're telling people to be quiet and to wait their turn actually is actually not helping to advance the movement. So I see an indictment there that many people think about when they just want to kind of be comfortable and they don't want to ruffle feathers. And I think it really just very clearly and succinctly articulates what the goals of the civil rights movement are and why he needed to act at the time that he was acting. And I think that there are things that he can still speak to us 60 years later in just how he is addressing issues. And it's a short read. So it's not like we're asking you to read a couple hundred pages.
I think it's a great lesson in writing. I mean, it's not something he spoke. It's not a speech, but it reads like something that should be spoken aloud. And I've spoken it aloud just because I think it's a great lesson in how to convey thoughts.
So, I think there are two things. One, I would urge people to move away from their two-dimensional characterizations of Dr. King. King was a real person, complexities, contradictions. His views and his tactics did evolve over time as he was confronted with new challenges, and we need to take them at face value. But the other thing that I'm struck by, especially in terms of his embrace of nonviolence, is that his goal was to affirm the humanity of the oppressors, to try to appeal to them based on their humanity, and to talk about redemption while also lifting up and affirming the oppressed and making credible demands for change. And I think in a moment where we are highly polarized, race being chief among those cleavages, but there are other cleavages, but also at a time where people politically make sport of demonizing their opponents to make political points, it is a lesson in remembering not to other people. And I think that his understanding of nonviolence and how he articulates that stands as a prophetic call for us to remember that you can oppose people without othering them, without demonizing them, and that when people are wrong, that there's a way to try to bring people along without necessarily seeking to try to vanquish them. And we've forgotten that. And I think they're really important lessons to us that apply not just to race, which we're still sadly dealing with today, but also apply to other cleavages in our society.
Last question. Is there anyone on the scene today who you think is in the mold or in the spirit of Dr. King, or is, to make that comparison, kind of blasphemy?
You know, I think one of the lessons that people learn, not just from a fundraising and organizing standpoint, from the civil rights movement, is to try to avoid kind of the singular leader model. I mean, this is one of the reasons why Black Lives Matter has tried to present itself as leaderful, as opposed to having singular leadership. I think that, you know, for many movements, you do need to have a clear and identifiable leadership team that's taking responsibility and is being held accountable for things. The message that, you know, I think what most people try to do in response to kind of like what we saw happen to the SCLC, which never went back to the heights that it had achieved during King's tenure as president after his death, is to try to think about the tactics and to try to take up the posture and to make people feel empowered to do this in their own sphere, wherever they are. So, you know, and I think also meeting this particular moment means that you don't necessarily try to copy King, even if you're trying to emulate sort of his spirit and some of the undergirding philosophies that informed why he took the actions that he did. I don't think we need to recreate King, but I think that there are things that lots of people can learn from and actually apply in their lives in their own sphere in the same way.
Dr. Andra Gillespie, thank you so much for joining us on this special day.
Thank you.
For more analysis of legal and political issues making the headlines, become a member of the Cafe Insider. Members get access to exclusive content, including the weekly podcast I co-host with former U.S. attorney Joyce Vance. Head to cafe.com/insider to sign up for a trial. That's cafe.com/insider. If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet. Or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to letters@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The editorial producers are Sam Ozer-Staten and Noah Azulai. The audio producer is Nat Wiener. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Jake Kaplan, Namita Shah, and Claudia Hernandez. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.
Support for this show comes from Vanta. Dealing with loads of spreadsheets, juggling different tools, and having to do manual security checks, it can be a headache to keep up with today's compliance and security programs. Vanta is the trust management platform that wants to simplify things and bring all your trust-building efforts under one roof, making growth smoother for your whole organization. Vanta lets you automate up to 90% of compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more. Strengthen security posture and reduce third-party risk. Get $1,000 off Vanta when you go to vanta.com/vox. That's VANTA.com/vox for $1,000 off Vanta.